There's no one quite like Sally.
Really? That's how we're starting?
Yeah, of course we are. Do you know, the nice thing is that only people of a certain age will know that tune. Name that tune in one. Go, Sally Lindsay.
That's There's No One Quite Like Grandma. And it was number one in 1980 for 4 weeks. The Christmas number one for 4 weeks.
And you sung it.
And I was seven in it. And I was a stand-in for the lead because I was still in infant school. So they nicked me from infant school.
How
I had
did
a tiny
it,
little voice.
How did that song?
That didn't last.
The minute it comes on, that any of us who were young enough to remember it, no, old enough, when we were young, that makes sense. When we were young, it came out. But everyone, everyone's grandma. There's no one quite like grandma.
It was quite a phenomenon, really, because it was basically just the way that came about. If you're interested, there was a song called Matchstock Men and Matchstock Cats and Dogs by Brian and Michael, which was massive.
And they painted Matchstock.
Yeah, yeah, about Larry, obviously. Yeah. And it was our choir was used as a background, and in just a normal school choir, like a local Stockport school choir. And that led them to write Grandma. And it was just an offhand thing that was never going to, you know, and it seemed to be the zeitgeist of the novelty record. And that was it. And we were everywhere. It was ridiculous. And then after that, we made about four, I was there for another 4 years.
So Winifred's Girls Choir.
School choir.
School choir.
Yeah, my brother was in it. And so I was there for another 5 years, and we must have made an album a year. And we made them at 10cc Studio in Strawberry Studios in Stockport.
You're kidding me? You made more?
Yeah, we made like Disney albums, Catholic albums, blah, blah, any album you could sort of, you know, put a kid on, we made it.
Oh, my word.
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm not quite up there with my husband, but...
Yeah, well, we can get to Steve, because...
yeah, but, I mean, you know...
What they called the start... No, I can't remember that. You know, Winifred School Choir, but the style...
Style Council, never heard of them, no. Never heard of them.
Who were they? Yeah, we'll talk about Steve and the twins and everything.
Okay.
But I love that that's where you started, and every... You know, that not everybody knows that of you, but when they do know it... You do twinkle when you talk about it because it's, I mean, you're 7 years old.
And it was great because I was with my brother as well, so I never felt frightened. He's 50 months older than me and still one of my best friends.
Oh.
And so I was with my brother, because I was really, really little. But I've always been quite brave, so I had a lovely time. And to be fair, people say, did that start you off in your career? Absolutely not. I didn't do anything till I was 24 after that. You know, just, I'd always loved drama.
What did you do then at 24? What was the thing you did at 24?
So I did, what happened, I went to university to do English and I wanted to work in radio. That's what I really wanted to do. Still do. Love it. And
I'm sure you could.
I'm sure I could, yeah, if I had the blooming time. But I know I really loved it. I really loved radio. And I think it's a great medium. And so I had my little radio show at Hull University. No one listened to it, the cleaner and... You know, it was
but
just
university
me.
Radio is really, really vital.
Yeah.
It's where most of the people
absolutely
in this industry.
I mean, but I think I wasn't quite the zeitgeist at the time because it was all terribly accents. You know, it was everybody, we were still there. And so I just sounded, I remember applying to a radio show up there in Hull and they said, we don't need another Terry Christian. Thank you very much.
They didn't.
Yeah. And I only wanted to sort of read the weather out or something. And I don't think people were banging their door down, but yeah, that was absolutely not wanted. And Hull's the strongest Saxon, even stronger than mine. You know, it's Irving Road. So I was like, oh, okay, fair enough. Anyway, somebody asked me to be in a play in the same year. It was my third year. And somebody had dropped out and I did the play. I'd already been interested in drama. My degree was English. And I was just really good at it. And I was, I've never said that about myself, about anything. You know, I've always been slightly above average, but I was just found it terribly easy. And I thought, oh, I'm going to audition for the next part. And I got the main part in the universe, which was no big competition, let's be honest. But and it was a play called Les Dangerous Liaisons. So Dangerous Liaisons. Yeah. Christopher Hampton, and I got the main part in it, Matoy. I was 21, I should have been 45 in it, so I could play it now. Well, I'm 50 now, but you know, that kind of age. And my film tutor came to me and he said to me, if, and he was called Neil Senyard, and he was a
Neil Senyard.
Senyard. And he was a quite a prominent film critique at the time. And he said, if you could write your essays like your act, you could get a double first. You need to think about this, Sally. And I said, but actresses don't look like me. They're not from where I'm from. And this is not being a working class hero. It was true. I didn't know anyone at all in my circle of friends, anyone that was remotely anything to do with anything like that. So I just, it seemed like I was going on a trip to Mars. You know, it was crazy. I was like, what does that mean? But you find your way, don't you?
So but that took 3 years then, because you say it was 24. You did that at 21.
Yeah, so what I did is I rang my friend Sean Canning. He's one of the biggest choreographers for huge fashion shows now. And he did a bit of dancing at the time. And he went, there's a guy who is a really good acting tutor called David Johnson. Now, David Johnson has taught the likes of Sarah Lancashire, Anna Friel, my friend Saran Jones, you know, Anthony Cotton, just a few, to name but a few. And he had a thing called the Oldham Theatre Workshop, and he was making a school for older people, and it happened to be the older people, I was only like 22, but it happened to be round the corner from my house. So I went and spoke to him and said, look, I have no idea. I don't know what I'm doing. And he said, oh, and he was quite standoffish and he was quite hard, David. But, you know, he always had a twinkle in his eye, but he was very good. And so I literally was with him being tutored for 2 years. And I just paid, I had three jobs, you know, just to pay for the tutorship, pay for my rent and stuff. And then, yeah, it was such a ridiculous story because it's so different from the RADA group or, you know, the people who went to drama school and they get picked by an agent. Yeah. There was a local agent. It was Ricky Tomlinson's agent. And I knocked on his door and I said, I want you to represent me. And he went, who are you? And I said, I'm an actress. And he said, what? Anyway, I mentioned David. He went, oh, no, I've heard of him. All right, then, what can you do? And he came
to... This is fantastic.
And I remember the dogs barking and everything, barking at me. I literally knocked this on this... The confidence I had. I don't know where that's gone. Honestly, I don't know. I think I thought, because I was so shown up telling my family I was going to be an actress. If I wasn't an actress, then they'd never stop laughing at me. I don't think there was this burning ambition to be this big Hollywood star. I think it was that.
It was purely because your family go there. We told you.
Told you. Well, they didn't. They just thought it was a bit weird and a bit, what are we talking about? Get a proper job, you know. And I've never had a proper job since. So then I got a, yes, and then he took me on as an agent. And it took me, as a client, sorry, he took me a few goes, a few auditions, but he got me a few auditions. And then I got a number one tour out of an open audition. And it was at the Strand and there was hundreds of girls outside. And they were all about 5 foot, about 8 stone, with tiny little dark bobs or sort of swingy little short dark haircuts. And then there was me. Massive doofus, like blonde. And I was like, oh, this is, I've been for the wrong thing here. Anyway, I got it. And it was called Girls Night Out. It was a touring comedy northern play. And I got it. And that was it. Wow. And yeah, I mean, there's been on and off patches, but not many, to be honest. I've been extremely lucky.
It's so funny when people see an actor that they know and everybody knows you because you've been in some of the biggest shows, and you've created some of the biggest shows and still going on. Madame Blanc,
and I've been around forever.
No. I'm talking about the stuff that you've done.
Thank you.
And as a presenter, and and as as somebody who's very passionate about a lot of things, politics, people, you're very passionate about looking after everybody. That I love that's how it all started. So it can't see, I do think a lot of actors think, if somebody wants to be an actor, they go, oh, well, I have to go to RADA, I have to go to Lambda, I have to do all of those things. No, you don't.
Not at all. And it's really funny, it's that eternal debate when you're on set with actors who have been to RADA and Lambda, which is amazing.
They are great schools. Oh, my God.
Amazing. But you always say, oh, you know what, I'd have always loved to have gone to that kind of drama school. And they say to you, why? So you think you should have gone, and they go, "There's absolutely
no point." That's always
so. It's the constant dichotomy. Loads of people, you know, but it is easier. I didn't make it easy for myself. But
no,
the problem was because I was working class. I'd used all my grant. We got a grant there at the time, back in the day, for university. So I didn't have any more educational grants. So I can't just turn around and say, "I want to be an actor now." They went, "Yeah, right, whatever." Then I didn't have any money to go. You know, even though I was good, and I was going to pay that back in tax. You know, 10 million fold. they didn't know that. So I suppose my tax money or my education fund had been spent on my English degree, which has come in very
useful.
But
that's come in handy because, you know, it's not like you haven't written since and you have, you know, hello, some of the, you've won awards and massive rating successes and so many things that you've written. You and Saran, you just mentioned, mm-hmm. I love that you say my friend Saran, I love that.
Yeah.
She's doing all right as well, isn't
never
she?
Never heard of her.
Yeah.
Never heard of her.
Saran, it's like Style Council.
Yeah, no, never heard of her. No, we were just, you know, me and Saran were mates. We met at Coronation Street, obviously. She'd started a year before, and there was three of us who were very close friends. Jennifer James, who played Gina, and Saran, who played, obviously, Karen, and me, who played Shelley at the time. And we were very, very, very close. And there was loads of us. There was Si Gregson and Keith Duffy and Lee Boardman, and Lee and Jenny had been married for, well, that long, however that long is. 20 odd years. And I think it was about, the thing about me and Saran was because we were just in all the time. Because she was she was sort of, you know, the Elsie Tanner type of the, yeah. of the, and I was behind the bar. So we were just in all the time. And I think we it was sort of meant to be, really, that, you know, we still are now. And
but you wrote together in a hugely successful writing partnership. And did that come from those? Did you have the ideas then?
Well, actually, we didn't actually write that. We created Scott and Bailey.
Oh, I thought you didn't write it.
No, that was Sally Wainwright.
But what? Okay.
But I created it.
Right.
With Saran. And what had happened, she'd left and Jenny had left and I was a bit bored and I met around the corner. She was a thing called Vincent with Ray Winston, which was all very good, but very like blokey and very, and she was running around in a little flowery dress and she was like, oh, you know, and it was a big break for her and, you know, she was breaking into that kind of drama. And she was like, yeah, but it's like, I don't really have anything to say. And I said, did you ever see a thing called Cagney and Lacey when you were a kid? And she's 5 years younger than me. So it's really funny that 5 years when you're a kid, it's sort of really...
it's huge. It's huge. A big 5 years.
It's nothing now, but it's huge.
Yeah.
So I explained it to her. She got a few, we didn't have, it was, got a video for her. We didn't have like, you know, I don't even think YouTube was going then. And I got her a book on the feminist Feminist Principle of Cagney and Lacey. And because my mum used to sit and watch it with me and I just thought it was the most amazing show.
I remember Cagney and Lacey well.
But it was so much more than it was. You know, it was basically two female protagonists and their lives and why everything was so much harder for them. And I said, why don't we make something like that? But, you know, 25 years on, set in Manchester with me and you and, you know, we're obviously, our characters are completely right for the characters that are, you know, we're going to set. And it took us about, I mean, we kept flogging that blooming show. We've written other stuff before, it's never got made. But we haven't done for years, actually. We must do that. But
I want more Scott and Bailey.
Scott and Bailey. That's out of my hands now. That's other people's, owned by other people's. But It was it, really. And I didn't do it because I was pregnant with my boys, so I wasn't able to do it in the end. When it finally got commissioned after 6 years,
yeah.
I was pregnant with the boys, which was a much more of a joy. But yeah.
But obviously now, at the moment, the thing that everybody, the buzz is about Madame Blanc.
Mm-hmm.
And many of my friends have been in it. I don't need to name drop, but bizarrely, my friend Harriet, who's been in it, our mutual friend, who's in EastEnders. Doof, doof, doof. Any excuse to talk about EastEnders. But and she loved everyone I know who went and has been on it. Loves it, and the audience love it, and it's escalated Channel 5 to doing more drama. So you've been quite. It's thanks to you that all of this has happened for Channel 5. I mean, you've had massive ratings.
That's a big thing to say, but I mean...
No, I am good. I'm saying it. I work for Channel 5. It's
very kind. I suppose, in a way, I think Ben Frow would always say that I was the first one to take a chance on the first drama, which was Cold Call. And that was the one that smashed through the two million.
That was massive.
So that was the one that... I think they tried a bit before, nothing really had smashed it, and then that was the one that
I loved. That smashed I loved it. Cold Call.
It was really good to do. I think you still could see it, actually, and that was a really interesting concept because it was a new way of filming. It was very pared down. It was budgetary constrained, but it was also very freeing. So it wasn't, there wasn't like a million of execs around all the time. You could essentially change lines with the writer's approval on set. You know, it was that, and I'm like that now.
But you were buzzing about that. I remember interviewing
loved
you
it.
About
yeah.
that. You
yeah.
were...
Loved it.
On cloud 9,000.
I loved it. I thought it was, and I really loved starting. And it felt like when I started doing Mount Pleasant with Sky, and again, that was the first, but it was the first big drama they had, they commissioned with Stuart Murphy. And I remember thinking I was at the beginning of something that was really exciting. And then Stella came along, and then there was Trollage, and I think that was at the same time. And we did really well. And then Sky, it just turned into, you know, go-to television. And it felt a bit like
Look
that at
how
the time.
Important you are
yeah,
in broadcasting.
Right. No, I don't think that is. I don't think that's the case. I think I'm just a fair pair, a safe pair of hands, really.
Yeah, but
everything's
also,
rolling.
You're very strong. So we'll talk in a minute about our mutual wonderful dear savage Paul O'Grady, who very sadly is probably watching us now and swearing.
Swearing.
Shut up,
you
two. You look at you two talking
going
about
on with
me.
Yourselves.
Yeah. You know what you want and you stick to your guns. That's how I can see you and Savage getting on so well. I think he got the gush from me and he got the straight talking from you.
It's funny, I was that mate really, and we worked together really well because there's a lot of stuff that, it's funny, I was cleaning my office out this morning because I'm obviously writing, hopefully writing the fourth one. And
Madame Blanc.
And my office was a mess because it always is. And I thought, this is ridiculous now. It's like the gaffer in the 70s. It's like everything's rubbish. So I was clearing it out. So, and I saw little notes, and there was a little note from his book, Eddie. And it was just really, I had to have a little sit down. And I thought, oh, bloody hell, because I used to always FaceTime him in the office. Are you in your shed with the mop? You know, give me dog them up. And so it was a bit funny one this morning, funnily enough. And then I was coming to see you. I was like, oh, that's weird.
Actually, the larks, let's go to Paul. Let's talk about him.
Yeah.
Because it's very funny because whenever I talk about him publicly, I'll always say, it's no secret, he was one of my dearest friends.
Yeah.
But we can sit here and we don't need to say that to each other.
No.
You know, he really was. He was very important in my life. And I knew him as Savage because we met on the Big Breakfast when he was Lily. And he was the first person to take me to the Vauxhall Tavern. I'd never been.
It's amazing.
And he was still Lily. And that was quite a thing. But, and then... Yeah, that it's in fact nearly a year ago since he died. It's March.
I was looking 25th. I was looking at my diary.
Yeah,
and 28th. Sorry,
that funeral.
Oh, and because I lost my stepdad about 3 weeks before, and he was very close to, and my husband woke me up in the middle of the night. No, it was about
it was horrible. That
four
message.
Or 5 o'clock in the morning. And he has his radio on in the night. He's one of those blokes that sleep
right,
through the radio, you know, with the noise, the white noise. And it must have penetrated. And he woke me up and I hadn't got the text from Joan. I'd not
that
looked at
text,
my phone.
That text.
And Joan is his wonderful friend, PA, but dear friend as well. His right-hand woman, Joan was. And I couldn't, I remember sitting at the end of the bed. And my husband was just saying, I don't know what to say, Sal, I don't know what to say. And I was just, I can't even put it into words. I cannot put it into words. I didn't believe it. I was in, anyway, you must have gone through the same thing.
No, I woke up my husband and I just went,
yeah,
Paul O'Grady's dead. And he just went, oh, don't be stupid. What is he, he thought because I was, and I went.
He's taking the mickey.
No.
He's gone.
He's dead. And he went, I did it so bluntly. And he just went, no. And I went, look. And I showed him the text and he went, are you okay? And
yeah.
I'm like, Savage. And I just went numb.
Yeah,
and it didn't make any sense to me because I'd spoken to him. And I had a note in my phone, a reminder to call him. And weirdly, the day that I was going to call him, and it was just about something, was the day that we went off and made the special just a few days after he died.
I'm in Vauxhall.
And I got a reminder on my phone, Paul Savage. And I was like, oh! And we all went off and did that special. Numb.
Well, it was funny because I got, obviously the calls came in to speak on television about him. And I was like, what are you talking about? But I remember when Bobby died, Bobby Ball, who played my dad for 7 years, I was very, very close to Bobby, as I was Paul. But Bobby was like my dad, you know, he was just so close. And I remember I didn't have the strength to do it. And I remember looking at the television and seeing these people that he couldn't stand. And I remember thinking, right. So I said to my agent, I said, I will do one thing. And the reason I'm doing it is because I can't bear all these people coming out of the woodwork. You know, like the cheeky girls and schnorbits.
No, but also people putting up photos of themselves with him.
I can't.
It makes me so... I just put up a photo of him and everybody knew. I don't need
a picture. I had a little one of him with his angel wings on when he came to see me at the Marlowe. And he said, go on, I'll come on. And he went on and the house just went.
Yeah.
He said, get me some wings. And went on. And the house just went. There's no point in going on after that. You know, he stole the show quite rightly. And that's why I did it. And I did one and that was it. And I've not spoken about it since today.
Yeah.
Because I just find it all...
Me too. I don't. I did that programme.
I wouldn't speak to anyone else if it wasn't you.
No, I won't. And people always say, oh, can you do an interview about Paul? I go, no.
Not ready yet.
But also, he would be like, what are you doing? What are you doing?
Talking about?
But we did that special.
And that was important.
That was really important. And Julian was there. And, you know, there was everybody there.
Yeah, the right ones. Yeah.
And his funeral, which we won't go into detail.
No.
But was the greatest funeral I have ever been to. If there could be a greater, I can't imagine a greater funeral.
It was just.
There was you and there were the other people whose names we won't mention. And it just felt so intimate and so special. And then there was a couple of wonderful moments that Savage was so much a part of.
He was a part of. He was there.
Some very funny things
literally
happened.
It was very funny. It was very well. It was something that I think he had thought a lot about. Let's put it that way. I think there was a lot of right. I think he would. Yeah. I think it was his plan. Let's put it that way.
There were two particular things, but we won't share what they were, but they were two particular
things.
But I
remember Al-Kar, who was there, and he doesn't mind saying that. He was, you know, he was a very old friend of mine. And Al-Kar said, you know, when we rang each other straight away, you know, and I said, I can't even imagine being asleep, Paul being asleep. Never mind dead. I can't even imagine being asleep. You know, we used to go out for dinner and I was always there and Vorders and we used to cry laughing. I mean, I was exhausted after a night out with them two. Can you imagine? Like them
I'd
two.
Be, yeah.
I mean, it was ridiculous. Yeah. And gosh, anyway.
Yeah.
He's still there somewhere.
He's so much there.
Yeah.
My
if anyone could do a comeback, it'd be him.
Oh, don't. That would... terrify the living daylight.
Oh, he'd love that though, wouldn't he? Aye, it's me.
I'm back. Oh, my word. Well,
full drag.
Do you know what? There's one of those things though, then it happens when certain people pass that I wish they knew.
Oh, how much?
I wish they knew the public outcry and the public, the love that was shown.
People were devastated.
My gosh. I think I had more messages about him than I have about, Terry Wogan, you know, another.
Of course,
obviously
I did love him.
Terry, but Paul was something, he was unique.
He was unique. He was unique. I wish he knew how
much everybody loved him.
I think he was just so honest. I think that was his. Yeah. He was unbelievably talented and unbelievably
very honest.
But he was so honest.
But with us as well.
Oh yeah,
he said it as it was. Mm. I remember there was a certain show I did, and he just called me up, and my mum died many years ago, and which I'll tell you a lovely story, which I will share about Paul. But he rang me up and go, what would your mum say? It was about something I was wearing. I was like, oh, thanks, Savage.
But he did
something very, very sweet, which I have talked about. But when my mum died, he left a message for me every day for 2 weeks on my answer phone. He left me something to make me smile. He left me messages. He left me jokes. He left me quotes, all sorts of things every day for 2 weeks. And he kept saying, Gab, don't pick up, don't pick up. And on the 14th day, he said, right, your 2 weeks are up. Now you can call me if you need me.
Oh.
But he did it every single day so I could get through the first 2 weeks after Mum died.
Oh.
And that was just kind. He was kind.
He was a very, very kind man.
Oh, so lovely, actually, talking about him. So, let's talk about Steve, who we did mention. He's a musician.
Yes, he's a drummer. So Steve, currently, him and his musical partner, Chris Hay, do all the music for Modern Blanc. So it's a bit of a family bespoke affair, is my little show. And he loves doing that, but you would know him. So he started drumming for the Style Council when he was 17, and then he drummed with Paul Weller till he was, gosh, I think till about 10 years ago, actually, 10 or 11 years ago.
Steve is so polite and unassuming.
Yeah.
Very gentle. You wouldn't think he'd done
two Live Aids and played every stadium in the world. And he's like, he's just not like that. His brother's not, though. Alan White, who drummed for Oasis, they're just very normal people, really, in an abnormal situation. Mm. But it's really funny because a lot of drummers are like that. They're sort of the powerhouse of the band, and they're the, you know, they're literally the beat, but they're also the, you know, they're the sane ones, the ones who haven't sort of lost their lives in drug-filled frenzy, the ones who that is basically maths and music, and it's a real, you know, it's a passion more than anything, and I think, and they don't get caught up with the stardom bit. Well, I know Steve never has, and he's never more mortified when people come up, because when people come up to me in restaurants, they sort of, depending on how much alcohol they've consumed, they either go out like they know me really, really well and sort of over friendly, which is lovely, or they get me in a headlock if it's sort of later
if it's later
on in the evening. Whereas Steve, they sort of treat him like some sort of demi deity, you know, and sort of nearly bow. It's so weird, the different kinds of fame.
That's so funny.
He was so taken aback when we got together. So it was like 20 years ago.
Yeah,
now.
So talk me through that.
Well, the real story is.
Oh, well, there's a fake story.
There's a fake story. I've peddled for years for the media, but you can have the real one. So basically, I was in Coronation Street, and I'd been there for, I think, 2.5 years, and I was really nailing it. I thought I was, and there was a new producer coming in called Tony Ward, who's a mate now. And he had a big reputation.
Well,
I know this person because he introduced me to Steve, but he was a new exec producer coming in. And on the cover of all the tabloids, he was called, you hate me for saying this, it was called Chopper Wood because everybody kept sort of getting sacked. So I was thinking, oh no, blimey heck. I remember looking at my little cottage thinking, well, what's gone on it? You know, I thought I was doing really well, but everything changes in soaps all the time. Serial dramas, I should say now. Anyway, and I wasn't ready to go. I thought I was just nailing it. I was only 2.5 years down the road. I thought, this is, you know, I'm nailing this. Anyway, I got a call from him. And I was like, oh no. So I'll cut that story there. The night before, Steve was on a tour bus, not with Weller, he was always in another band, Steve, and it was always in like a drum-led band, drum sort of funk-led band, when he wasn't playing with Weller. So he was always on the road kind of thing. And it was called The Players. And it was fantastic. It was like his acid jazz band. It was fantastic, The Players. I really loved them. Anyway, they were on the bus and they'd had a few tipples, and they were saying, who do you fancy off the telly? But not obvious.
And did he say you?
Not obvious? Yeah. Said me. Who else did he say? Oh, he was going to kill me for this. He said me and Sophie Rainworth off the news. Do you remember the blonde? Well, she's amazing.
Yeah.
He said me and her. And that's who he said. Now, he'd forgotten he'd said that. Completely forgotten. So that blonde woman behind the bar in Coronation Street, and that's Sophie Rainworth. And he woke up in the morning, and his best friend, Matty, who was his manager, said, he's still his friend, mate now, said, I've got a surprise for you. Guess who's coming to the gig later? Tony's asked her to come.
Oh, that's just fantastic.
Hang on a minute. Cut to me. I'm thinking I'm getting a sack, aren't I? So I get the call off Chopper Wood, I'm thinking. And it was the most awkward phone call, because he was going, hi, it's Tony Wood here. He put his telly voice on.
Oh, did you go into
a shock? Yeah. And I went, hi, Tony. Yeah, just wanted to sort of touch base. You know, I'm a new producer. And anyway, I've got a great friend who's in town tonight. He's a drummer. He's a great band. And I just wondered if you wanted to bob down so we could meet. He's a big fan of the show. Anyway, I went, what? And he went, I said, are you not sacking me? And he went, oh, God, no. And it was really, I think I swore. It was really embarrassing. And I went, I'm so sorry. And it was dead. It was so awkward. So then I was like, I can't believe somebody's rang me up to meet in a nightclub. I said, that's a bit out of order. Anyway, my best friend Claire Bradley, and this is how long ago, her son's 21 in February, this is how long we've been together. He'd had complications when he was born. And she just rang me up literally 5 minutes after and said, Sal, you can come in. He's all right, you can come in to meet him. And the maternity hospital, St Mary's, was opposite the academy in Manchester. So I thought, well, I'm here now, so I may as well bob in, you know. I may as well go in.
Oh, my word.
I said, I would not have gone in. I was, because I was dead angry that I thought, how dare I should be met in offices. I was a bit on my own backside then. We should meet in offices and I should be, you know, introduced to the new producer and all that. And I just walked in and I met him. That's when I met him, yeah. I'd never have met him before.
And that was it?
That was it, yeah.
Oh, my
It was a bit
word.
On and off for 6 months because we were so busy. He was on tour and I was in the Peter Barlow storyline. So I was we were never available, but it was really exciting because I used to fly out and see him at gigs and stuff. Because, well, it was great. He was a big Corrie fan, so he's great. I was allowed on the bus and stuff.
Oh, just, you do, and I know I just said it, but you do know Peter Cake, you
never go
with
out.
Peter, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, Pete. Yeah, of course I did for years ago. I don't see him as much as I'd like to now because I'm in London and Pete's in Manchester.
Is he all well?
Yeah,
he is.
As far as I know, he is. Yeah,
good.
Yeah,
good. And he does his residency in London as well. Is he still
doing
that?
He does the O2, doesn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, I've been. I
can't get tickets.
This summer. He wouldn't give me free either.
He would.
Peter.
But you do know everybody. No matter who wherever I go. I can be anywhere, the end of the
Iceland.
UK. I could not be anywhere and somebody will say, oh, you know Sally Lindsay. How did that come about?
I don't know.
But you do know everybody. You keep them. You don't throw people away.
No, and I always have a massive cast list in my head. Of people.
Do you?
Always, yeah. It's like this, it's bigger than anything.
So Madame Blanc, you're going to do more?
Yeah. Hopefully.
So we're right.
It's not been green lit yet, but it's doing really well.
It's doing really well.
Hopefully.
So when you come up with a character, do you think that's, okay, I want them for it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean...
And does anybody ever say no? I can't imagine they ever say no.
Nobody said no yet, no. I mean, some people have not been able to do it, but no one's ever said no, I can't, you know, I don't want to do it because it's rubbish.
No, it's not rubbish.
Everybody said, oh God, yeah, I'd love to, and then maybe it's not worked out time-wise.
Who would you like that you haven't had yet?
Let's cast. Well, I've got loads. I mean, it depends on the part.
Okay.
So
Can we do fantasy casting?
Oh, I'd have everyone, wouldn't I? Well, I've had really fantasy casting because, like, for example, Sue Holderness, who everybody knows plays Judith in the show but was in Only Fools for many, many years as Marlene. And I did the Vagina Monologues with her in 2008. And I remember sat on the chair next to her just looking at her. She was in the middle. And then sometimes she was on the end, we swapped round. I just remember looking at her thinking, you are the most amazing actress. And just staring at all with her. So usually it's not about people I don't know. It's usually people I've met that I feel right. Because the biggest thing to me, Gabby, because I'm 50 and I can't be bothered. If I don't...
You don't suffer fools.
No.
But you never have.
So if I don't like them, I don't want them in.
Yeah, but that, yeah.
Or not don't like them. If I met them and I just thought...
They're negative people.
Yeah.
You just want positive
can't have
people
that,
around
no,
you.
Can't have that nonsense. Too old. I'm too off that nonsense.
Oh, you
can't
see, you
that.
Don't...
But you're the same though, aren't you?
I like positivity around
exactly.
me.
Exactly,
I like good
I can't
people.
Handle it. Yeah, I'm too old for that. And it's not, I've got to say, it's not happened that many times in my life, to be fair. But when it does happen, it can change a show.
Yeah.
And it's really important to get that balance right. So it's usually, however much I'd go, yeah, they'd be great in it, I'd think, oh no. Like, for example, I just got in this series, I've got Stephen Bailey, the amazing comedian, and we met mutually through my business partner, Caroline Robert Cherry, and I just absolutely loved him. And I said, can you act? And he was like, I don't know, I've never tried. And he was absolutely brilliant to the point where my director went, he's got to come back. He's amazing. I loved working with him. And I was like, see, sometimes you just give people a platform or a chance.
Joe Lycett.
Oh, Joe, God, I love him. I did meet him 1 year ago, and I remember thinking, you are so clever.
He's
I think
so
it
clever.
Was,
he's a lovely guy.
It was the thing after, what does it, the thing after Bake Off when they have that chat. Oh, no, the thing after The Apprentice when they have that chat.
Yeah.
And they asked me on that show, and he was there. So it was many years ago when I went on, right at the start of his career. He's so bright.
He's lovely.
Everything he does is amazing.
The first season of this podcast, he came on, and people hadn't, it wasn't quite that people got him yet.
Yeah. And it was just waiting to happen, wasn't it?
Oh.
I could see it straight away. I thought he's going to be massive.
And he's so bright. It's a funny way, you know, he's on it.
Oh, no, I watch everything he does. I think he's fantastic. I think
you've got to get him in, but I can see him in Madame Blanc.
God, whether he do. I mean, whether you say, you know, it's amazing when you see these people and you think all the comedy's been done, all the drama's been done, all the singing's been done, and then all of a sudden people like Joe Lycett pop out, you know, and you just go, oh, it's not.
Yeah.
There you go. There's more genius.
But also it's about taking a chance. And I think television can be too safe these days. And I, you know, but that's a whole other conversation. Sally, just carry on doing what you do.
Do you mean employing the same cast
no,
all the
no,
time?
No, I just mean it's all a bit safe. You know, I like rebellious and naughty television. I think that's why I love what Joe does as well.
Yeah.
I mean,
totally.
I come from naughty television.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
So
I
think that, and I mean naughty with a small N, not late night. Strange television.
No, what have you got on you?
you sound like Savage. Oh, my God. Long may you reign, and you will. So you've got other ideas. There's other stuff as well.
Yeah,
surely.
So we never have
ideas.
We have a company, which is me, Caroline and Martin, and it's called Saffron Jerry Productions, and we have lots of things on our slate, but it's quite female led. I like diversity, but I also like women of a certain age. So I think what happens is women get to a certain age and then you just don't see them on the telly anymore, and you go, why am I not seeing them on the telly anymore?
Because but no, people like you, Sarah Lancashire,
yeah.
Jamie Lee Curtis, I know, yeah. We're going, but suddenly out there it's like, hallelujah, you're not invisible. It's
no,
important.
Because women want to see us. This is the thing. And once you're brave enough and bold enough to say that and say, women want to see women who look like themselves.
So do men. I mean,
men do. But, you know, that's who I'm writing for. And it's brilliant because when people come up about Madame Blanc, it's usually couples. And that was like Mount Pleasant as well, weirdly. But it was couples and, you know, or we get, or people just really enjoy it. It's like a bit of I just wanted to make an hour of escapism, really. I thought the world was so horrible during the pandemic and so hard. It was sort of a fantasy that I created, really, that I wanted this sort of vision of loveliness, and you wanted to go and sit in that pub and you...
Please keep doing it.
You wanted to look at that antique and you wanted to look, you know, spend your night with that mad couple from the chateau and have a, that's all I wanted. You know, it sounds really simple, but this recipe has to be right.
But actually, simple is the best. It's when you can describe something on the back of a matchbook. That's what
that's telly, isn't it?
Saying.
Yeah.
That's when it really works. Sally, thank you.
Is that it?
That's it. Thank you.
Oh my God, we could have gone for us, couldn't we?
Thank you.
Love to see you, love.